It's an old adage, of course, that the show must go on, and even in the face of tragedy like what happened earlier today in El Paso, where, as it stands right now, at least as of last report, 20 dead, a couple dozen injured still. We don't have reports on conditions or whether anybody else might be hanging on by a thread to raise that body count. We are still gathering facts and still trying to comprehend yet another shooting tragedy in America. This, as it stands, is only the eighth worst mass shooting in our history. Only eight. But at least to me, they don't get any easier. Caller last night to Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM said that he noticed that when we were talking about the Manson family murders, the Tate LaBianca murders from 1969, which we'll be celebrating the infamous anniversary coming up this Thursday of 50 years since the first of those two killings, it seems like people just are kind of, if not numb to it, at least it doesn't shock like it used to. And of course, he's right. Evil doesn't seem as potent, or as the contrast doesn't seem as scary as it once did in 1969. And right now, we have a just from as of the last report, we have a body count that's four times greater than the Manson family murders at the Roman Polanski mansion with Sharon Tate and her friends. And people are still sorting out what to do about all of this. Yet it's important to acknowledge it. It's also important, as I said at the beginning, that we continue to do a show almost despite it, so that it doesn't just become the only thing we can talk or think about. So we're going to go ahead with our scheduled interview with J. Michael Straczynski next hour. He wrote Becoming Superman, My Journey from Poverty to Hollywood. He's the creator of Babylon 5. He wrote the script for Changeling. He had an amazingly terrifying childhood, which may be very informative for what's facing us right now as a nation. We'll get into that next hour. But we will talk to him, and we will talk about science fiction, and we will talk about entertainment, and we'll talk about how he recovered from the circumstances which would have led almost anybody else into becoming a member of the Manson family, in light of what we learned last night with our guest Diane Lake. And so we will do that. But in this first hour, we're going to spend a little time sorting out what we know, and we will revisit as scheduled our other guest from last night with whom we spoke, Deborah Herman, the co-author of Member of the Family, the Diane Lake book. She has a book out, a new book about the Manson jury, which we will talk about a little bit later on this hour. But he's been kind enough to give us some time to get the show started in the way in which we should, which is addressing the issue that's facing us. John Lott will join us in just a second, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, to give us his insights into the deadly shooting today in El Paso, Texas. And we'll talk to him next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Deborah Herman was very kind to give us a little more time away from what we had scheduled originally with her so that we could make room for John Lott, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center since about 2016. John, I know that you have the right mix here of a background in academia and research, but that you also keep your eye on the real world as it unfolds. So let me ask you, if I can, just right away, what are your thoughts about the shooting today in El Paso at the mall?
Well, I mean, we're still learning a lot about it. Still have questions to answer. It seems like one of the common features you see across these attacks is that you have someone who wants to commit suicide, but is going to do so in a way that's going to try to get them attention. And this individual obviously planned this attack long in advance, very carefully planned. And that's another common feature you find about these things. I don't know how long in advance this individual planned it, but from the comments of the police and how he staged the attack at a major entrance and basically making it hard for people to escape, put a lot of thought into this. If you look at past attacks, 6 months is a short amount of time for somebody to plan it. You look at something like the Sandy Hook attack, the person was spending about 2.5 years at least planning the attack in that case. I've seen conflicting accounts on whether it was just at the Walmart or also was at the Dillard's in the mall. If it was at both, I'm still trying to find out whether guns were allowed in the Walmart that was there. It's clear that they were not allowed in the Dillard's store. One thing that you see in virtually all these attacks is these killers like to go to places where people aren't allowed to defend themselves. You look at the attack that we just had in Gilroy last week. There were metal detectors there in order to prevent anybody from having weapons inside the area. The killer there went to a back fence and cut a hole through there and went in, basically knowing that the civilians would be unarmed in the place. You go back to the Virginia Beach attack that we just had recently. You had something similar that happened there. The killer did his attack in an area where there were only public employees, and public employees were banned from having concealed handguns.
But this is Texas, and one thing I had heard, and again, as you say, we're all still kind of in the information gathering phase, is that there were people in the store that had, I mean, Texas is not just concealed carry, but it's open carry, and that there were people who did have guns, or they had guns in their car and they couldn't get to them, or, I mean, there's been a couple of different conversations about it, that he walked in shooting. He just walked in. And right. That there was no that because he was shooting, he was firing from the outside walking in. So gun detector, you know, anything that would be outside would have been of no consequence in this case anyway, because he was just going to walk through no matter what was happening. But this notion, too, that he posted a manifesto,
right,
which I think now police have confirmed. That this was an anti-Hispanic attack, at least at this phase, that's what it appears to have been about. That's why he drove from Dallas to El Paso. This is fairly consistent with even the summer when the FBI reiterated their concern about the radicalization of the far right, and that, you know, certain websites take glee in, it seems, or at least don't do anything to discourage conversations about doing things like this. It just, they figure most people won't, but some people obviously are.
Right. Well, it's kind of hard to know whether he's right-wing or left-wing just because he's a racist. You look at the New Zealand killer, which this killer cites in his first sentence, saying that he basically agrees with what was in the, or he says he agrees with what was in the manifesto from the New Zealand killer.
The Great Replacement.
The New Zealand killer was also racist, but he was a socialist and an environmentalist, and his racism was based on environmentalism. The reason why he didn't want people from third world countries, or minorities, he used the terms interchangeably basically, to come to New Zealand or Australia, was because they had lots of kids, and he was concerned that having lots of kids put a strain on the environment, and that it was important to leave it for only European types there because they wouldn't have as many children. So, you know, if this killer today or on Saturday has the same views as he's indicating there, I mean, who knows what his political views are?
Well, except you read the manifesto, right? And he makes no mention of socialism or anything about that. He just talks about a kind of the white nationalist position.
That's right. The only thing I have is he refers to, in the first sentence of his manifesto, he refers to agreeing with the thrust of the New Zealand killers manifesto. Now, as I say, I don't know. Who knows what the guy's political views are? I'm just saying,
right,
just because somebody's a racist, you can have somebody who's a socialist, apparently, and a racist, or somebody who's an environmentalist and a racist. The New Zealand killer, who he refers to, was definitely those. So,
okay.
What you often see in the discussions that you're looking at is, if somebody's a racist, he's classified as a right-winger, just because he's a racist. Even if he has lots of other statements that come out that indicate that he has other views. And if you go through and actually look at the people's views, there's really not the relationship between right-wing killers and, you know, being right-wing and killing in these mass attacks that that a lot of people make it out to be. And I don't know if you read the New Zealand killers manifesto, but that's pretty clear. I think the vast majority of these killers have no political views other than maybe being a racist in many cases.
Well, the New Zealand killer based his manifesto, The Great Replacement, on the Great Replacement manifesto, or the tract that was written by the French writer, who is part of Marie Le Pen's group. When he said originally, I agree with The Great Replacement, I wasn't sure which one of those manifestos he was talking about, but it's a fair point. The FBI says they are investigating this as domestic terrorism. This is consistent with some of the other warnings that they had been putting out about the rise of domestic terrorism in this country. Do you, as part of the hope of your organization as a crime prevention research center, what can we do to prevent crimes of this nature? Is there anything that you are working on or research indicates would have an effect on stopping people from doing this?
Yeah, well, I guess I would just point out this is a worldwide phenomenon. In fact, it's much worse in the rest of the world than it is in the United States. We've looked at all the mass public shootings around the world that we can get data on. The U.S. and Europe, it's easy. In other parts of the world, news media coverage is less than perfect. But if you look at the time from 1998 through 2017, you find that the United States makes up less than 1% of the world's mass public shooters. We make about 4.6% of the world population, so we're less than the average. But to get to your point, and that is a common thing that you see around the world, is how quickly you can get somebody to a place with a gun to stop these attacks. And in the United States, we have a little over 600,000 police. You probably don't have more than 250,000 on duty at any particular time. In a country of, you know, almost 330 million people, it's pretty hard for them to go and cover all the possible targets that are there. And the question is, what's the alternative? And the alternative is to try to encourage people. We have about 18 million Americans that have concealed carry permits, but encourage people who have permits or legally carrying to have their guns with them in order to try to stop an attack if it's going to occur. You know, it'd be great if the police were there all the time, but police have a very difficult job in stopping these types of mass killings. And that is, if you have somebody in uniform there, and these attackers, these terrorist types of attacks, and I agree that it should be characterized as that, have huge strategic advantages. If they see an officer there, they can wait for them to leave the area before they engage the attack. or they can pick another target, or they can kill the officer first, because they know many times if they kill the officer first, they'll have relatively free rein to go and kill other people then. And so the question is, what can you do in order to try to take away that strategic advantage? Now, you could have undercover police in different places, but that's going to be pretty costly to have that. Or you can go and let people with permanent concealed handguns, because if you can't identify somebody who's has a gun there, you know, a uniform is kind of like a neon sign for these killers to say, shoot me first. If you have concealed carry, then that takes away that strategic advantage. On our website at crimeresearch.org, we have literally dozens of cases in just recent years where people with permanent concealed handguns have stopped these attacks before they became mass public shootings. Cases where the police or sheriffs or prosecutors have said, if it wasn't for the presence of the concealed carry permit holder, would have many people would have been killed. And these are dramatic cases that, I mean, I can give you a number of them. One, for example.
No, I'm sure. But in the case like this, police have said in the past, the first thing to do is run, right? I mean, if you can get away, get away. Then the second thing would be to hide. And that if you had an ability to fight back, you should. Other times, there's a concern that if there are many people firing, when the police get there, they won't know who's responsible,
right?
And that would create more confusion. Is there a way that you all have found that there's a way to engage a shooter but also not create the confusion that some law enforcement are concerned about?
Right. Well, I mean, we don't need to guess about these things. We can go and actually look at all these cases where a concealed carry permit holder has stopped the attack.
Right.
And what you find is that the types of fears that you raise don't occur. There's no cases where a permit holder has stopped these attacks where they've accidentally shot a bystander. And if you look at any of the cases where permanent concealed handgun holders have been allowed to carry, legally allowed, there hasn't been a single case where the police, when they've arrived on the scene, have accidentally shot a permit holder. These attacks usually occur very quickly. When you have somebody with a gun there, you have a couple things that happen. Either one, the killer commits suicide, or which is very frequent, or they essentially just give up. These guys may be cowards in some sense. The point of these attacks is, just to kill people, and they want to commit suicide themselves, though.
But in this case, that wasn't what it was. He didn't. It wasn't death by cop. He could have. Instead, he shot until he stopped, and then was taken easily by police. He gave up no resistance.
Right. And what they'll find usually afterwards, I mean, you have similar things like the Aurora Batman movie theater shooter, others, where they've took, because about 75% of the time these killers die at the scene. But in the cases where they don't, where they've interviewed them afterwards, these people planned on committing suicide, but just couldn't, when it actually came to killing themselves, just couldn't pull the trigger. And whether or not this guy is like virtually all the other ones or not, I guess we'll find out later on, now that he's alive and was captured.
Right.
But if he's like the vast majority of these other killers, it'll come out that he just couldn't bring himself to kill himself at the end.
John Lott, thank you. I know this was a burden on the last minute, so appreciate you making time for us and for giving us your insight from the Crime Prevention Research Center. And as we continue to gather more facts, I know that that George will also continue this, I'm sure, in some form next week as we begin to know more. But have a great night, despite what we're experiencing all as a nation, another night of knowing that perhaps that's our only hope,
So we have to talk on cases like this, but not other times. But I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. We will get to Becoming Superman with J. Michael Straczynski coming up, and it will be fun. I promise you that, although I think he may have something to say on the subject as well. We'll have lots of time for his fans, and there are many of them. So let's look for every opportunity that we can throughout the night to enjoy something fun and to relax, like a little impromptu bluegrass fiddling and playing with my friend Matt from the Vertebrats and George and Martha Taylor. Let's play this going into the bottom of the hour and get ready for Deborah Herman as we talk about her new book about life inside the Manson jury next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So I gave the numbers there not just because we didn't have a chance to get to everybody last night who wanted to talk about the anniversary of the Manson family murders and their particular stories, their connections to the case, but also because Deborah Herman, as a researcher and a writer, a true crime writer, she knows a lot about that period. So, and as much as she knows, I mean, she helped shape the story of Diane Lake, so she might be able to answer questions that people had that I couldn't get to about Diane last night. She's also the author of Inside the Manson Jury, From Deliberation to Death Sentence. It's, you got to hear the story of how this whole thing landed in her lap and what we know now that perhaps we never knew before about what happened during that trial. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Deborah Herman, thank you for making us allowing us to have a little time with John Lott earlier this hour on the shootings for today. I can't help but ask you, though, too, since you are an expert on that era and as a true crime writer and somebody who no doubt is plugged into the news of the day as well, with the sad anniversary coming up on Thursday, the 50th anniversary of the deaths in the Polanski Mansion, Cielo Drive, how do you look at the impact that the Manson family murders had in 1969, with a relatively low number compared to the mass shooting that we see today, and unfortunately we see all too common now?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because what I've been pondering in preparation of our conversation tonight is the fact that I get a lot of blowback or pushback from people saying, how could you be focused on such darkness? Yeah. And my origin as a writer and even my passion as a human being is really more of a spiritual nature, mystical nature. And I was attracted to all of this because I understand that the Manson story and what we saw today with this awful mass shooting has at its base the very same thing. Manson was able to be this mega figure because what he did is he created fear. That was his goal. That was his strength. And what the terrorists do, even though the person you had on before me was saying that they just want to kill people, that's really not true. They want to create chaos and fear, and they want to draw attention to themselves. Even if they're planning to commit suicide, they want to go out literally with a bang, no pun intended. They want to become, they're looking, it's like, they're seeking the attention, they're seeking the news, they're seeking their 15 minutes of fame, even if it's posthumously. And they really want to create pain, and they want to create, I think it's mostly fear, because fear is the direct opposite of faith.
If Manson were alive today, I mean, if it happened today, let me put it this way, do you think we'd be looking at the attacks in Hollywood, the two different murders over the course of that period, as acts of domestic terrorism?
Potentially, I think that we might put it into a different lens, only because we've had so much history now between 1969 and today, where people have done these mass shootings, and they've, some of them you could say, well, it's it's just attributed to one crazy person, but a lot of times we're finding some kind of, as you mentioned earlier, a manifesto or
right.
some kind of statement. I do think we would look at it. I think even back then there were people who could have looked at the Manson murders as domestic terrorism.
But we weren't using that. It's funny, that was sort of reserved
for
like
the term.
Right. But we talked about like the Black Panthers. We would be talking about, underground movements, and there were different language that we used back then. But as one of the controversial, not to me, but I was really glad last night when we were talking to Diane, and I asked her as a member of the Manson family whether she could confirm the way in which Vincent Bugliosi had summed up Manson's intent was to create Helter Skelter, even if he didn't call it that, but it was to create a political and social rift between whites and blacks until there was a war, and then he would step out. In a way, that's every bit kind of the same motivation of a lot of terrorists. They want to create unrest, they want to create fighting amongst people, so they're going to kill innocents in order that they may be able to take advantage of the chaos.
I agree with what you're saying. However, my understanding of Manson is that you can't forget that, and this is my opinion, and my opinion, I believe, is shared by Diane, Manson believed in his delusion, and
right.
his delusion was that he was in some way the second coming.
That's true. And gotta throw that in there.
Yeah. So if you look at it this way, if you think you are God and you are the second coming, and first you came in as the Lamb, okay, the next in his mind, as everything was not going the way he expected it to go, he wasn't given the record deal. He wasn't recognized as God. He was treated, he was treated by the people in society as something less. He's becoming more enraged. And so he's going beyond, he was just raging and having a pathological temper tantrum. He became the angry God.
Yeah.
And so, there's so many layers to this case and to this, to the mind of Manson. And that's why it's just, in my mind, it's just so crazy that I'm actually editing even a third book, which we won't
right.
get into tonight. I've become this repository for all things Manson because it's so significant in our in the history of us as a nation.
You're probably the perfect person because you don't fetishize it, and so you'll have the objective eye. Let me grab Walt here. He's on a wild card line, and he just wanted to comment on something we were just talking about. Walt, are you there on wild card?
Dr. Punnett, it's great to speak with you once again. Needless to say, we're all saddened by, this latest ridiculous tragedy. Dr. Punnett, I'm an endowment member of the NRA. I just want to say that, they're going to call for nationwide banning of all firearms. I mean, this is what Hitler did. I mean, if we ban firearms...
We were going to talk about Manson, I thought, right? So let's go to that quickly, because I don't have a limited time here for you, bud.
Right. Well, Manson had a swastika engraved on his forehead, and I think, he's a Hitler in microcosm. Both Hitler and I heard Manson were... abused as children. So I think that they had an inferiority complex that they were trying to overcome.
Well, let's start there.
And I do think that what you're saying makes sense in that you create a certain, there's always that petri dish that grows and creates the perfect storm And we see with Manson that there's a point of change. After he leaves jail in 1967, he comes out thinking he's going to become a pimp. He's all set, and he is a, you know, he's lived in institutions. He's a career criminal, and he comes into a world of, you know, free love, all of these dime store gurus. And so it's a whole different thing for him. And then he also indulges in LSD. So he's already on the verge of any human being has with so much trauma could potentially become, you know, at minimum a sociopath or enraged at society. But he also continues to go into madness. And so you're absolutely right. And eventually, when everybody goes through their madness, they typically, their brain expands into this paranoid delusion where they start to think like Hitler. You know, it was a logical pattern for him to ultimately, and I don't believe that he first did a swastika.
No, that was after. Yeah.
And I can explain what I believe. I mean, I believe, if you want to question whether or not he believed in Helter Skelter and the race war and all of that, he was originally, in my opinion, marking his forehead because he believed in revelations. And in revelations, those people who are marked are the ones who are going to survive the Armageddon. And in my opinion, that's what he was doing. And so later he turned it into a swastika. And probably because when he's in prison, he's going to be part of the Aryan Brotherhood. That's also a safety factor for him. So there are so many layers to this, but I appreciate the caller's perspective. And frankly, I don't think we need to worry that there's going to be a blanket removal of all weapons. That's not going to happen anytime soon.
East of the Rockies, Joe is in North Carolina, and I'm just trying to get everybody in and still have a time here for a few minutes to talk about the new book. But Joe, it says here that Tex Watson, that you knew him as a kid?
I was a youth pastor in the late 90s and, well, mid-90s, early 2000s. And I got to know Charles Watson's family really well. Oh. We went to church together, and he had a wonderful family. And I made it a practice to meet the kid's parents that I was youth pastors with. So I was able to go to the prison that he was in, and I own California, and sit down with Charles Watson for a couple hours. And it was just a wonderful time, actually. I mean, he appeared to me to be a God-fearing man, changed his life. I have nothing but good things to say about him as a person today, and his family as people today.
Okay.
I can't speak for the past, but it was wonderful meeting him, as strange as it sounds.
But, no, that's fine. I can speak for the past, though. I think his past was awful, so I'll just say that. But
well, and I'd like to just comment. I appreciate that you're doing that kind of ministry, and I believe all human beings, you know, the best possible outcome is for someone to make a form of penance.
Right, amends.
Frankly, that's between him and God. And as far as I'm concerned, because I am a lawyer and a journalist, and I have read the 20,000 pages of trial transcript, although I didn't read Texas trial, I've also spent innumerable hours with Diane Lake. I know all about what happened. And, you know, it was horrifying. And we cannot forget the victims.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm more inclined to appreciate God's infinite forgiveness, but we also have to consider and uphold the law. And, you know, these co-defendants were all given the death penalty. And whether you believe in it or not, they were never commuted. It was because the death penalty was taken off the table.
Right.
And so, you know, the fact even that they're coming up for parole is that was never intended. And so that's why the new book, Inside the Manson Jury, for
yes.
anybody who still questions, you know, the guilt or innocence, at least from our legal system, I don't think you're going to walk away from this new book with any questions.
Well, I'm so glad to. So perfect transition. That's why I'm laughing. It's I've been trying to talk about this for quite a while, but it seems.
I know, because you and I are both so in. I mean, I hope you enjoyed the book. It's so fascinating.
It is. Inside the Manson Jury, from Deliberation to Death Sentence. Deborah, I think probably all we're going to have time for in this whole thing is for you to be able to explain how it is you came across the majority of the text.
Oh, believe me, that's a good enough story right there, and people can take the time to read the book on their own for the details. But here I had written the book with Diane. We took a year's journey. We unpacked all of her memories, and so I only had a little bit of time to look at the transcripts and only really focus on her testimony, and I noticed all of the shenanigans, and I'll say shenanigans, to show how manipulative Manson was.
Right.
And how, you know, how he did program either through becoming God to these people and through the cult programming, or fear and intimidation. And so what happened is I was contacted by phone, which in my office we get so many cult calls, so I only was half listening. And this guy said, I have a book for you. And I said, oh, okay, go email me. I got the email, and he said, my uncle was the jury foreman on the Manson trial. I read your book, and I want to know if you want to see the book. And I'm like,
yeah.
You know, my head's just exploding, and I called him immediately, and I said, how about yes? And it is a time capsule written at the right after the trial, 1973. Helen Tubick and Herman Tubick, he was the foreman, and she was his wife, and he had kept notes during the trial, and he was a mortician, and he was a very conservative, straightforward, serious man, and he took copious notes. So the book is like this time capsule, as if you're sitting in the trial.
Mm.
And hearing what's important for each witness. And then what I did is, with this beautiful historic artifact, is I became, you know, bleary-eyed going through the original transcripts, matching the days, because if, for example, Herman Tubick said, and in the courtroom, Manson threw a pencil at the judge, or one of the girls knocked over Bugliosi's, that's the prosecutor, knocked over his papers, then I would match that day and see all of these arguments that were out of the hearing of the jury, of things that Manson would say that were intimidating, that were crazy, that were, you know, obvious that he was manipulating all of his co-defendants to only focus on him being found not guilty. That was his, or being able to save his own life. He had no concern about anyone else. So it's a fascinating.
It is.
It's fascinating, and I don't think anybody's ever gone in such a deep dive from a factual, historic perspective of what happened at this trial.
I think it's a gift. And thank you so much for gifting us your time, both last night and tonight, with all of these, with both of these books. And for people who are looking forward to trying to understand all that better, great place to start. You can link up to Deborah through coasttocoastam.com. And thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again sometime, maybe hopefully on a night when, well, I guess tonight we will have fun. And I promise we would, and we will. Becoming Superman, J. Michael Straczynski, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.